Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What forces motivate us to do the things we do, and can we make the world a better place by understanding how incentives really work? My guest today has looked at everything from student motivation to discrimination to the wage and power gaps between men and women, and he has concluded that adjusting potential risks and rewards can have a significant effect on overall outcomes. John A. List is Homer J. Livingston Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. His new book, written with behavioral economist Uri Gnizi, is called The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
We should say at the outset that your research differs from that of many of your colleagues in that you prefer to work almost entirely outside a lab setting. Talk about why that's so important to you.
That's exactly right. So what I tend to do is I tend to go out into the real world and put people through what's called a field experiment. So when you think about the empirical work that has been done to date, you think about things like Freakonomics and how the people who do Freakonomics actually go about their empirical work. And what they do is they look at mounds and mounds of data that, for example, the government collects to answer their questions. Now, what I do is I ask similar questions, things like, why do people discriminate? Why do people give to charity? Why do women earn less money than men? But what I do is actually go out into the field and generate my own data by putting people into experiments. So if your listeners have voted in the past few presidential elections, or if they've used TurboTax, or if they've flown United Airlines, it's likely that they have been a subject in my experiments without actually knowing it.
And the fact that we don't know causes us not to amend our behavior in any way.
Exactly. So the key is that when you go out and look at sensitive behaviors, as we do in the Y-axis, what we're looking at are behaviors that if people know that they're being scrutinized or watched, they might actually amend their behaviors to be more in line with what society tells them they should be doing.
So you remind us near the top that it's going to be important to understand the difference between self-interest and selfishness. Tell us about that.
That's exactly right. So selfishness can be defined very narrowly as, I just want to make as much money as possible. Now, that's much different than self-interest, which is measured as, look, I just want to make myself as well off as I can. Now, self-interest can include things like altruism or spiteness or guilt or being kind. But the key is that once we know that people value those things, we can put those incentives alongside money incentives, and then we can figure out exactly why people behave the way that they do.
Does that cause all the other economists in your department to sort of look at you with a raised eyebrow?
You know, it does a bit, but I think through a little bit of introspection, everyone realizes that it's not just money that drives our behaviors, and other things like keeping up with the Joneses or revenge or spitefulness, these are actually important motivators in society today. So I think my colleagues, if they honestly assess our current economic thinking, I think they say that I'm a welcome character to this research pursuit of the truth.
So we talk about science a lot on this show, and social science in particular, and it's not often that an author makes a point of reminding us about the separation between correlation and causality. And I'm glad that you inserted that into the book, because it's something that if we don't really think about it, we can accept certain results as true that might not in fact be valid.
You know, I think you're exactly right. When you look in the real world, so when I take my kids to downtown Chicago, what we observe is we observe a lot of overweight people drinking Diet Coke. Mm-hmm. So I say to my kids, do you think that drinking Diet Coke actually causes you to be obese? Because that's what the data would look like. And they will say, well, no, it's obese people who are drinking Diet Coke to try to lose weight. But that was that's an obvious causality that runs in the wrong direction. But when we think about advertisements and sales amongst retailers, it's clear that people presume that more ads lead to more sales. But when you look into the data and dig really deep, it's really hard to find that causality. There's correlation because in November and December, retailers tend to place more ads and they have more sales. But that correlation doesn't mean that it's causal. What's happening is that around the Christmas season, people place more ads and people tend to buy more because they're buying for Christmas presents. So I think if you don't realize that there's this third variable, a culprit that might be causing both of these things to happen, we can many times take correlation to be causal.
All right, and let's discuss incentives here because there are positive incentives and there are negative incentives, and they are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
I think that's right. When you look at the entire suite of things that a manager can do, for example, to motivate her employees, on the one side, you have typical bonus schemes. So if you do well on your job at the end of the period, you receive a bonus check. Now, what we find when we do experiments with teachers, for example, we have a large-scale field experiment with teachers from K through 12 here in Chicago. And what we find is that those kinds of incentives don't really work very well. But what does work well is if we give those teachers a check up front. So we give teachers a check in September and we tell them that if your kids do not improve academically, you will have to give us some or all of that money back next June. What happens is teachers work really hard in that case because they do not want the money taken away from them.
And that makes sense because, you know, if it's just free money if you hear about it at the end and you think if I get it, great, but if I don't, no big deal. But once it's sort of in your account, that feels like yours. And I guess that instinct that we have toward loss aversion kicks in.
Exactly. Exactly, Chris. You've hit the exact point that psychologists have taught us for years, psychologists such as Danny Kahneman, who wrote a wonderful book, and in the late Amos Tversky, and other psychologists have shown us that once we have something in our possession, once we own something, we place a lot higher value on that good, and we need to be paid a lot to actually give it up. And the slang for that is that people have loss aversion that dictates their choices.
How often is social pressure a really big impact on the choices that we make and the things that motivate us?
You know, I think social pressure is probably one of the most underrated features of mankind. And let me give you a few examples. So the first one is with charitable giving. So every year, Americans give about 2 to 3% of their wealth, or let's say their income more appropriately, to charitable causes. And social scientists for years have been arguing that the motivation for why people are giving is because of altruism. You know, people really want to help other people who have had bad luck, for example. Now, what we found is that while altruism has some import, it's actually social pressure that has an even bigger influence on why people give to charitable causes. Now, this social pressure works through many different forces. For smaller donors, if a Brownie Scout comes to your door and knocks on your door, you get up and you go to the door, and there's an incredible amount of social pressure. Once you answer your door, you say, well, given that I'm here, I'm going to give you some money. I will buy 5 packs of your cookies. Mm-hmm. Now, that social pressure also works for really large donors because society tells them that the right thing to do is give away some of your wealth to help the more needy people across the world. So social pressure works not only for small donors but also large donors. Now, in a very different walk of life, it also manifests itself. And what I'm thinking about is the preference for competitiveness across men and women.
Yeah.
What we talk about in the book is that one reason we believe that women are paid 80 cents on the dollar that men earn in labor markets is because men are much more competitively inclined than women. So, as the theory goes, when there's a promotion or when it's time to ask for a raise, what you find is that men really go after it and they fight like mad to receive the promotion or the raise. And women are much less competitively inclined than their male counterparts. And what you find then is that women receive fewer raises, fewer promotions, and a lot of it is because they are just much less competitively inclined than men. And a lot of that is because society tells women that being competitive or acting in a very competitive way is not ladylike, and that's not the right thing to do.
But not every society says that to their women.
That's exactly right. So we have a compelling story in the Y-axis where we actually visit a matrilineal society. Now, this society is in India, and it's a tribe called the Khasi tribe. And what you have in that society is essentially a bizarro world in the Seinfeld sense, where women in this society tend to make the important decisions rather than men. So when you knock on the door of a Khasi household, what you have is a man answers the door, he greets you, and he brings you in to the woman of the household, and then the man will go and sit in the corner while you talk to the woman of the household about important village events or important decisions that the village needs to make. So in this way, we found a society that is just about the exact opposite of what we have in the Western world. In fact, when we were there, we were driving around the various villages in India, and we saw signs, and we said to our driver, what does that sign say? Because we keep seeing a sign that has a strong message. And our driver said, well, that's the various male groups in the country who are arguing that they want equal rights. So it's really, sort of where we were in the States with minorities and women decades ago. That's where these villages are in India, where the men are actually asking for equal rights. So now what we've done is we visited these households several times, and we've run them through simple field experiments to test whether the men and women have competitive inclinations like our men and women do here in the States. And what we find is something, I think, marvelous and amazing, that their women act like our men, and their men are about as competitive as our women. So that got us to stumble upon this insight that, you know, men and women are not born that differently from one another, but where the differences manifest themselves is how society tells them they should be behaving and how society tells them they should act in the job market or act in school. And that's exactly what happens, is they act in those ways.
My guest is John A. List. He's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago and co-author, along with behavioral economist Uri Gnisi, of the new book, The Y-Axis, The Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John A. List. He is Homer J. Livingston Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago and co-author of the book The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, John, in a perfect world, I'll just speak for myself here, men and women would be compensated equivalently for the same work. They would be promoted at the same rates for the same kind of work. I think all of us would also pay the same price for the same goods. But it turns out that is not something that happens.
Yes, that's true. And I'll tell you, Chris, I like that perfect world that you're talking about as well. But unfortunately, as we talk about in the book, that's just not true. Now, when it comes to paying different prices for the exact same goods, unfortunately, again, what we observe is that many times people pay 20, 30, 50% more than another person who buys right alongside them. Now, our experiment that we talk about in the book, the Y-axis, is sending out disabled people who are in a wheelchair to get price quotes to fix their cars. Now, what we observe there is when we initially send them out, people who are confined to a wheelchair end up paying about 20 to 30% more than people who are not confined to a wheelchair. So now as an economist, you oftentimes ask, you know, why do people in a wheelchair pay more money than those people who are not disabled to fix the exact same car? Now, what we observed is that the auto shop mechanics actually felt that the people in wheelchairs actually went out and got fewer price quotes. So they thought they could charge them a higher price and they would make more money because the disabled people actually would search fewer mechanic shops and therefore they would pay the higher price. So this was just a way to know that the mechanics are simply trying to make more money and they're willing to use whatever information they can to make more money.
So while the results are reprehensible, the idea is not that they see a disabled person and sort of want to do them harm. They just don't think that they're going to be in a position to get competitive bids.
Exactly. I think you hit on a very important point because when we look historically in the U.S., when you look at the 50s and the 60s, you had a lot of racism based on hatred or sexism based on hatred. People would try to harm someone else just because they derived satisfaction from harming them. What we find is that sort of behavior, while it's still out there, while that kind of reprehensible behavior is still in the world today, it's actually much less prevalent than this other kind of discrimination where people, they don't really hate you, but what they want to do is they want to use all information possible to make more money. Mm. And what's scary about that is that in this world of technology and in this world where we go on the internet to shop, we buy books on the internet, we buy airline tickets, we do our banking on the internet, what you become very afraid of then is that you have firms and companies out there who are leveraging that information to actually make more money from us.
What happened when you sent pairs of guys into car dealerships with different instructions?
Yeah, so that's an interesting study, which we talk about in the book. So we're also interested in how sexual orientation affects people. In particular, that experiment was we sent partners and also pairs of gentlemen who were straight. We sent those two types of bargainers out to the real world to actually bargain on vehicles to purchase. And in the end, we actually purchased a few vehicles. So we want to make sure when we run these field experiments that we make it worthwhile for our subject pool. So we actually get cars fixed, we buy cars, we hire people. Now, in this particular case, what you find is that the gay partners received very, very high offers. And what I mean by that is if they go out to buy a car, if dealers know that you're gay, they end up charging you a lot higher price than if they think that you're straight.
Why?
You know, what we find is that a lot of that was driven by hatred. It was not driven by the dealerships are trying to make more money. It was driven by dealerships that are just averse to dealing with a gay couple, and they do not want gay couples to receive good new car offers, which is quite sad in this modern world that we have today.
It is sad. And what's interesting here is that you're sort of taking apart different kinds of prejudice, and we'll talk in a minute about what you found about racial prejudice. But I suppose it's important to remember that we can't look at all these things and try to understand them using the same tools. They have to be considered individually.
I think that's right. I think in many cases when we talk about anti-discrimination laws, we like to paint those solutions into one corner. So when you look at affirmative action or the Rooney Rule in football, everyone has written these policies based on the discrimination is because of hatred or animus or prejudice or bigotry. And in this world, each kind of discrimination should be unpacked differently. And there really isn't a one-size-fits-all anti-discriminatory policy out there.
So another thing you did, John, was send different individuals of different ages, sort of dressed differently, different races, out and had them ask for directions from strangers?
That's right. That's right. This is another study that we did in downtown Chicago where we send different gentlemen out of various age levels and different races, and we ask various people if we can have directions to the Sears Tower. And the Sears Tower we knew was 5-6 blocks away. And what you observe in those interactions is that the people who could potentially be deemed as, quote, dangerous, unquote, people in the eyes of our experimental subjects, the young black male, for example, the young black male was treated very inappropriately. They were not given the right directions in many cases. In many cases, they were simply ignored. And what we found is that was because the people who we were asking for information felt in harm or potentially in danger. So they were trying to cut short the conversation as quickly as they possibly could.
And I want to jump in here. Your young black males did not say anything threatening or do anything threatening.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, what you observe is that when you send a young black male with a hoodie and, you know, dressed appropriately, they're not treated well. But if you send that exact same young black male in a business suit, then they are actually treated well. So what the black males could do in that particular case, first of all, the discrimination is reprehensible, but there is something easy that our young black males could have done, and that's to dress like a young businessman, and in that case, they are no longer discriminated against.
Of course, that does sort of put the onus on the individual who has been the victim of discrimination, and people might say, well, why should I have to, you know, it's my Saturday, why do I have to put on a business suit just to get directions to the Sears Tower?
Absolutely. I mean, you're exactly right. This should not happen. You should not have to jump through extra hurdles to receive equal treatment. That's certainly correct.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. All right, I want to talk about this. We have a fundraising drive coming up in just a couple of days here, and that's not why we invited you on the show, but I was delighted to have some interesting information here. You write here about Smile Train, which is this organization that does surgeries for children in the developing world who were born with cleft palate. And they tried some really counterintuitive things in trying to raise money and had some surprising results.
That's right. That's right. I think this is probably our biggest surprise in the book when it comes to why do people give to charitable causes. So you're right. Smile Train is just a wonderful charity that sends doctors to developing countries to fix cleft palates. And Smile Train's interested in raising money, just like many 501c3s are interested in raising money. And we came to them with various behavioral economics ideas, And through our brainstorming, one idea that came up was something that we call once and done. So what this means is that we send millions and millions of people letters where we say on the outside of the letter, give once and we will never bother you again. So when we first talked about that idea with fundraising practitioners, they told us we were crazy. They told us, why in the world would you ever ask someone for money and then tell them you will never bother them again? In fact, fundraisers have for decades professed that it's really, really important to build a donor pyramid, that you should secure new donors and then set up the incentives so those donors will continue to give over and over again for decades to come. So they told us, you know what, you're crazy. You don't want to tell donors that you will never contact them again. So what we did was we sent out millions and millions of letters, and the letter basically said, if you give today and if you check this box, we will never contact you again. And what we found was something amazing. What we find is those people who receive that once and done offer, they end up giving about twice as much money as those people who receive the standard letter from SmileTrain Give. So that's really good. We raise a lot more money. But then the next amazing result comes is that only about 34% of people who are offered the once and done option actually check the box. So what that means is that now we're left with 68% more people who have told us, look, I'm interested in giving to SmileTrain in the future. So now we can contact those people and we can save money on that other 34% who really don't want to be bothered by SmileTrain. And, you know, it costs roughly 40 cents a letter to send out these solicitations. So it's actually important information to have someone tell you, you know what, I don't want to be bothered anymore. And when you look at future giving, so then we track these people over a several-year period. Those people in the once-and-done treatment actually give slightly more in the future than those people who were approached with the standard letter.
So, John, what is it about being told we won't bother you again? Is it catching those people who really are willing to help once, have other things they want to give to, and don't want to be bothered, and then they sort of trust that they'll have that happen to them?
Right. I think that's part of it. I think the bigger motivator in this case is that the most important asset that someone like SmileTrain has is that they have the power of the communication channel. So they can send me, once they have my address, they can send me a letter every week if they want. So I realize that as a potential donor, that the most important asset that we share between SmileTrain and me is that they own the communication channel. And I think the way donors perceive it is that when SmileTrain is willing to give up that communication channel as a gift to potential donors, the donor actually reciprocates and ends up giving more money to SmileTrain because they feel that that gift of the communication channel is actually a very kind gift.
How important is the sense that donors get that they have done a good thing?
You know, I think one of the most important motivators behind charitable giving beyond social pressure is this fact that people give because it makes them feel good. And economists have coined this term, they've called it warm glow, that donors actually have this warm glow, a warm fuzzy feeling inside every time they write a check. And that's a very important driver when it comes to actually getting out the checkbook in supporting the United Way or the Make-A-Wish Foundation or the local university, that people just get a really good feeling because they're helping a cause.
So they are taking care in that instance of their self-interest even as they're giving money away, because they, in exchange for their money, they get to feel really good.
Exactly, exactly. I think that's a very important point that you make, Chris, is that what we find is that even in the world of charitable giving, that self-interest is a very important driver, because a lot of why we give is to make ourselves feel good about giving.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Marshall in Denton. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really enjoy your show and catch it whenever I can.
Thank you.
Okay, I just had a quick question regarding what he brought up about the pairs of men going and buying cars.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that there are a lot of people in the old guard, as it were, that look at gay couples as older, white, and with two male, quote-unquote, incomes. Hmm. And I was curious to what degree, say, the partners would be a victim of income discrepancy, believing that they have more money to spend and therefore should be utilized as such.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. What do you think, John?
No, absolutely. That's a great question, is that essentially when a couple enters a dealership, the dealers look at a few things, and one important feature is, you know, how much can this person actually pay for a car? So in our particular experiment, we actually have the same two people entering the dealership, and in some cases they enter as partners, and in some cases they enter as a straight two fellows just entering the dealership. So that very important variable that Marshall is mentioning is exactly an important variable to think about. In our experiments, we actually hold that equal across the partners who enter the dealership.
Hmm. My guest is John A. List. He's professor of economics at the University of Chicago and co-author of The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John A. List, who is the Homer J. Livingston Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago and co-author, along with behavioral economist Uri Gnizi, of the new book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, another thing that you and Uri took a look at was early childhood education and how to provide it most effectively to kids at risk and how to get their parents truly on board with the importance of this. Can you talk about what you learned?
Sure, sure. So, Chris, I think one of the most important questions that we face in America today is our education gap. What you observe in the data is roughly, you know, a half year to three quarters year difference between African American and Caucasian children. So when we look at our education gap, we find that most of our problems end up being in urban school settings. So what we've done is we've begun our own preschool program here in Chicago, where we actually started two preschools for kids ages 3, 4, and 5 to figure out exactly why do our minority students end up lagging behind our majority students, and what are the best interventions that we can think of to make sure that all children actually have a fair chance to succeed in our modern economy. Now, what we found, and we're in our fourth year now of studying, and we have about 1,000 kids every year who are part of our field experiment, what we find is that a very important way that we can actually help the underprivileged youth is by not teaching the children directly, but by teaching their parents about how they should be teaching their children. Hmm. And simply by setting up what we call parent academies, we can make an underprivileged child within 3 months look nearly as good as the children who are being raised in much, much wealthier communities.
And you also discovered to get the parents really on board with this, if you treated enrollment in the parent academy almost as if it were a prize, they were much more into it than if you just said you have to come every Tuesday night at 9 or whatever.
I think that's right. When you look at our program, I think many, many parents were very skeptical about whether we could actually make a difference. So early on, we actually had problems with attendance. We had parents who were not interested in attending the parent academy. So what we did is we set up incentives for the parents. We set up incentives to have the parents attend all of the parental meetings. And we also set up incentives that if the parent actually showed a good effort in trying to teach the child, and if the child improved on standardized test scores, that the parent would actually receive an even larger incentive. And what we find, though, after roughly a year of the parent being in that program, the incentives that you have to use to convince them to continue to come to the parent academy, those incentives are much, much lower because the parent actually realizes the power of the parent empowerment programs that we've been running, and now we have to pay the parents much less for their attendance.
Does it work to pay kids to get good grades?
Now, that's a controversial question. In general, we've looked for roughly 5 years at what are the best ways to incent students. And that result is very similar to the result that we have for teachers that we talked about earlier. If you just pay kids in the normal way, for example, for every A that you earn in a class, we will give you $5. Mm-hmm. Kids end up not being very excited about that because that reward is too far into the future. What they're more excited about is, here's a $20 bill, and if you achieve, you can keep that $20 bill, but if you don't achieve, you will have to give it back. And an incentive like that really does work well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Daryl in Dallas. Hi, Daryl.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm calling because earlier in the conversation there was a scenario that Mr. Liss had brought up about the black gentleman wearing a hoodie going into asking directions to Chicago. And I was wondering if he had done a reverse of this, basically trying to eliminate possibly the hoodie from the intimidation, saying if he had a white gentleman asking the same directions, was there was that factored in also, just to see if there was a different reaction from the same people or different people, you know?
Great question. Thanks, Daryl.
No, that is a great question. So We do have a treatment like that, and what we find is that while that white guy wearing a hood is treated more poorly than when that guy goes out without a hoodie, he's not treated as poorly as a young African-American gentleman wearing a hood.
And for all the, assumptions that we're not very competitive and we don't deserve as much money, women tend to not have problems when they ask for directions and that sort of thing.
That's correct. So the fairer sex actually does quite well when asking for directions, especially young, physically attractive women. Actually, they receive the most attention of all, and their directions are spot on.
So what happens when we use young, physically attractive women to collect money for nonprofit organizations?
Yeah, that's a great segue. So that's an experiment that we've done as well, and we talk about in the book. We actually do some door-to-door fundraising, and in some cases we send a college student who is, let's say, a knockout, a 9 or a 10 on the physical attractiveness meter, and in other cases we send a woman, say, who is a 6 or a 7, and we also do the same thing for men. We send a 9 or a 10 on the male attractiveness index or a 6 or a 7, and what you find is that for men, the physical attractiveness really doesn't matter that much, but for women, it matters a ton.
Hmm.
So, for example, if you would move from, say, an average woman to a woman who would be an 8 or a 9, she would raise about 100% more than the woman who would be deemed as average on a physical attractiveness scale.
But she's not necessarily garnering lifetime donors.
That's exactly right. That is a great point, Chris, is that even though it works in the short run, when you go back to those donors who you initially attracted to give for the first time, if you don't continuously go back to them with a beautiful woman, then they will tend not to give. So, you know, what we find in the end of the day is that you can get short-run blips in your fundraising or in your sales if you're a corporation, but you won't attract the loyal customers who will continually give to your cause or buy your product if you then go away from that physically attractive salesperson.
And what happens when we appeal to people's generosity rather than sort of forcing them to make contributions? There was this now pretty famous experiment at an amusement park. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. So what we've also done is when you look at, for example, these pictures that are sold in amusement parks. So when you get off of a very scary ride, you walk down the line, and of course you see a funny picture of yourself making a scared face. This happens up at Six Flags. It happens in experiments that we've done down in Walt Disney World. And what we find is that if we couple a charity alongside those pictures, and what I mean by that is in one case you walk off the ride and they ask you to pay $9.99 for the picture. In another case, what we ask is, you can pay $9.99, but we will give half of the proceeds to charity, a charitable cause. And what we find is that that's a very powerful way to raise money for your charity, is combining a private good, the picture, with a charitable contribution.
How important is it that everybody around you sees you making that contribution?
Oh, that's a good point. It ends up being extremely important. What we find is that when somebody is observing your behavior, whether it's giving to a church collection box, giving to a charity, or, Chris, even washing our hands, what we find is that if we're in a public restroom and if somebody is in that restroom, the person is much more likely to wash his hands before he leaves the restroom if somebody else is in the restroom. If nobody else is in the restroom, about 3 or 4 out of 10 people actually walk out with never washing their hands at all.
Oh. that is something I wish I had not learned. Really?
That's true. So this power of observation is extremely strong. So, you know, one way to push public sanitation is just put a pair of eyes in public restrooms. Just by having eyes in there, that will cause people to wash a lot more than if there isn't even a fake pair of eyes in the restroom.
So in terms of sticks and carrots, John, I mean, how important is it that we take away the option for people to buy themselves out of their obligations?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and one that we talk about in Chapter 1 of the Y-axis. So, you know, incentives work in sometimes very strange ways, but they end up being very predictable once we realize what the person values. And what we talk about in the book is a daycare experiment that we ran in Israel – where people were constantly late picking up their children. So what the daycare did is they imposed a fine and said, if you're late, you have to pay the daycare a fine. Now, the fine was so low that what happened when they imposed that fine is that more people ended up being late. So their incentive actually backfired. When they added a fine, they actually had more problems with tardiness than they did before the fine, because once you put a price on something, that fine ended up serving as a price, and now you took away the moral obligations of being late, and you said now you can buy your way out, and people are perfectly fine paying that price. And in the end, the incentive backfired because a lot more people were late picking up their children.
So reading this book, talking to you this hour, suggests to me that we think we know what's going to make other people act in certain ways, but we very often might really need to do some science to find out for sure.
That's exactly right. I think the overarching point of the book is that there's received wisdom, there's wives' tales, there are these anecdotes that have been passed along from generation to generation about what works and why people behave in a certain way. And when you actually put science to it, now all of them aren't wrong. Some of them are exactly spot on, but many of them are wrong. And if you don't add science to the equation, we would never know that we're making incorrect decisions. And with a little bit of science, with a little bit of field experimentation, we can actually learn about what drives people to behave in certain ways and what are the best incentive schemes to set up to get people to behave in the ways in which we want them to behave.
Are you running any experiments right now? Is there something you're investigating these days in the field?
I am. In fact, an interesting experiment that I'm working on now is trying to figure out why people go to the polls and vote. See, there are these arguments out there that, you know, people just view it as their civic duty to go and vote, or in some cases, people actually believe that they can affect the outcome of the vote. What we've been finding is that a very important incentive that actually very few people talk about is that many people go to vote so they can tell others that they voted.
Wow. Well, I guess it's worth something. John A. List is professor of economics at the University of Chicago. His new book, written with behavioral economist Uri Gnisi, is called The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me, Chris, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.